Welcome. This podcast focuses on connecting to the history that is all around us in our own communities and the stories that shape who we are. Our fifth episode will focus on the region known as the Little Cities of Black Diamonds here in Southeast Ohio. We'll learn the stories of how these small towns help shape the world and talk to some of the people who are preserving this important history here today. I'm Brian Costco, and this is Invisible Ground. Myself and Invisible Ground would like to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of Kaskaskia, Osage, Shawnee, Adena, and Hopewell peoples. You can find this show wherever you find your favorite podcasts already, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. If you enjoy Invisible Ground, please help us out by subscribing, rating, and reviewing the show. You can also find previous episodes and more information about our other projects at findinvisibleground.com. If you're interested in being a sponsor or have an idea to share with us, you can email findinvisibleground@gmail.com. And if you'd like to support the show and the work that we do, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/invisibleground. A quick note for this episode's sponsor. The mission of Little Cities of Black Diamonds is to keep alive the past stories and traditions of the Little Cities of Black Diamonds region. And through our history, culture, and environment, help enrich the future quality of life in the region. You can find out more about what Little Cities of Black Diamonds does, as well as community events and ways that you can contribute at lcbdohio.org. And you'll hear a lot more from people involved with the organization throughout the rest of this episode. Thank you, as always, to the Southeast Ohio History Center for their continued support of Invisible Ground. You can visit athenshistory.org to learn more about what they do. And thanks again to everyone who's contributed to this project so far in any way. You can see a full list of sponsors and supporters on our website. And be sure to check out our first immersive historic marker. Well, the first of many. It's in Uptown Athens at 15 North Court Street, right across from the former location of the Barry Hotel. You'll be able to see the historic Barry right there on your smartphone's camera just by using the app, which is available for Apple and Android. Our second marker will be arriving later in September 2022 at the Mount Zion Baptist Church in Athens. And now, let's head up to the intersection of Perry, Athens, and Morgan counties in the beautiful hills of Southeast Ohio. In this episode, we are going to talk about the Little Cities of Black Diamonds, a region of small towns, villages, former settlements, company towns, and mines that dot the landscape of Athens, Perry, and Morgan counties here in Southeast Ohio. These small towns tell a mighty history, from the birth of the United Mine Workers and other labor unions, to a history of extraction of the very coal, clay, and oil that would fuel America's expansion in the 19th and 20th centuries. The people in these small towns would make a huge impact, both here in our own region and far beyond. While we can't fit it all into one, I felt like an introductory episode to the Little Cities was important for a historical study of Southeast Ohio. And it was important to understand the history, culture, and the work that's being done today to preserve all of those things. So let's start with a bit of orientation for our geography and the people and places involved. The next voice you'll hear throughout our episode, John Winnenberg, helped found Sunday Creek Associates, the Little Cities of Black Diamonds, and he works with Winding Road, Ohio, among many other places. He grew up in Corning and still calls the Little Cities home today.
Talking about a cluster of communities at the corner of Athens, Perry, Hocking, and Morgan counties that all sprung up as if by magic, I think was a term that was used at the time. In the late 1800s, as the railroad was able to get to the coal here, and immigrants came from all over the world, and African-Americans came out of the South to mine the coal. And so it created this series of little cities, and they all aspired to be great places. It's everything from Jobs and Murray City to, you know, the bigger towns are Gloucester and Shawnee and New Straitsville, and Nelsonville is considered a little cities, but, you know, there are a lot more remote places like Hamburg and Modoc.
According to their own website, the Little Cities of Black Diamonds Council is an initiative that was launched and managed by Sunday Creek Associates. Sunday Creek was a nonprofit formed in 1990 to promote community development in southern Perry County, One of the first steps taken by the organization was to understand the history of the coal mining communities in southern Perry County, under the belief that it's hard to know where you want to go unless you first know where you've been. And also the idea that the first step in healing wounds is to understand, well, how they were made. The organization also viewed this as a way of understanding their own assets and building on them. They did this through oral history collection, archival work, events, education, and other kinds of direct and indirect work in the community. A group of people who've taken it upon themselves to preserve the history and use it as a tool to propel the development of these same communities.
What we've been about and what we continue to be about is understanding our story and learning from it. And also, as time has gone on, we've realized it's such an asset that it's part of our redevelopment strategy in these remnant mining towns. In terms of history, we've kind of narrowed it down to three major themes. And one is labor and the coal mining process, obviously. The second one is immigration and ethnicity and the melting pot of people that came here during the coal boom. And the third is the environmental journey that this land's been on since the trains arrived and the immigrants arrived to mine the coal. And so those are the three themes that we concentrate on. And all three of them are relevant to life today.
My name's Cheryl Blosser. I have volunteered and worked for the Little Cities of Black Diamonds for 25 years. I've always loved history, but the further back and the more difficult for it to understand was what I liked better. I really wasn't into so much of the, you know, this date, this war thing. I wanted to find out why or who and, you know, how do you know, and that sort of thing. And as my kids went to school, I started doing a lot of volunteer work at school. I met John Winnenberg, particularly when my daughter was selected to do a project on town landmarks that might be lost if something wasn't done to educate people. Well, I realized that local people didn't know these things, and no one had ever connected the fact that all these people that lived here contributed to so much of national and state history.
Among countless projects helmed by Cheryl over the years is a mine registry, one that aims to connect the names and places with all the people who populated these valleys and hills. The story of labor history in this region is huge, and it's one that is set up by the conditions that were faced by those who came here to work. Like most important moments in history, it exists at an intersection of several important groups, ideas, and people coming together at just the right time.
During the first wave of immigrants, they brought with them some knowledge of the labor movement. Towns like Shawnee, New Straitsville, and Nelsonville, some of the earliest towns that were formed. They quickly wanted to establish some parameters for their work. Cheryl talks about a crossroads of time. All these situations were right at the same time, and it created this environment for the labor movement. And the most fascinating part of the labor story to me was the struggle between unity and division among the miners and how some of that was planted to divide and conquer rather than unify. And really the calm leadership of someone like Chris Evans and a few of his allies who stood steady through all of this and really created for America a much stronger labor movement that took off from there in the forms of labor unions like the United Mine Workers that grew out of these hills.
I don't think people realize until they really look at it. In 20 to 25 years, they changed the world. The coal miners were 50% of the American Federation of Labor, so they were the biggest influential group. They fought, they organized, they made sure to get people to vote, to elect officials that would listen to them. And they actually got protections written in place. You couldn't count on the coal company to protect you.
And those protections, the concepts of unions, labor movements, can all be found here in the 19th century. The Hocking Valley and surrounding areas were known for their rich coal veins. And once the railroad extended into Nelsonville in 1869, that town and the spurs that could arrive into it would begin a boom for the whole area. One led by coal, clay, and extractive industries. New Straitsville would be founded in 1870, connected by rail a year later, making it the first big boom town. It grew to over 4,000 residents by 1880, with only a little over 700 still remaining today. These towns and mines were creating products and literally the power to push America through its Industrial Revolution boom. And as we'll see, not usually getting those same benefits. This environment would create the little cities of black diamonds, but it would also give rise to the modern labor union movement. Miners and other workers would begin to meet in secret. And by 1870, unions would begin to spring up, like the Knights of Labor, and they would start organizing meetings. Christopher Evans, who John mentioned a moment ago, was a New Straitsville resident and organizer. During the Hocking Valley coal strike of 1884 and 1885, Evans used nearby Robinson Cave as a location for his secret meetings, with the story being that the great acoustics of the cave allowed them to whisper and not be found out. The story also goes that in 1884, some of those same miners who had been striking pushed a car of burning coal into a mine that had been owned by the New Straitsville Mining Company. That fire still burns today, in what is possibly one of the longest continuing burning man-made fires in the world, at just about 138 years. In that time, it's chewed through the same rich coal vein which those companies had sought to extract. It's said that smoke still comes from the ground throughout the Wayne National Forest and surrounding areas. In 1886, the Knights of Labor founded their own rival to the National Federation of Miners and Mine Laborers. This led to several years of dissent between the two organizations. But in 1890, Christopher Evans called the two groups together in Columbus, ending disagreements and forming the United Mine Workers, a group whose roots are in the whispers of Robinson's Cave.
There's a story of a guy who got on a train in Philadelphia, went to Pittsburgh on a regular passenger train, and then he and his family were put on a flatbed car with benches, and they rode in the open air from Pittsburgh to Corning, where they discovered that they were brought in as strike breakers. And when they found that out, the entire group of them went on strike the first day they arrived in town.
These company towns filled the region, made up of settlements, mines, and train stops throughout the hills, each one its own little universe. Bustling towns with movie theaters, opera houses, hospitals, and neighborhoods would return to nature in many cases, as quick as they arrived. These are company towns. And the companies, or the coal bosses themselves, would put the capital in and own the property, providing often terrible living conditions for their employees and profiting off of the exploitation of their labor and the resources of the land. Workers would often be paid in company scrip, which is printed by the company, exchanged for products in the company store. If it seems like I'm saying the word company a lot, it's because I am. It's just another example of the continued exploitation of Appalachia and Southeast Ohio by outside forces. These resources and economic benefit from them are both being shipped out of the region.
There's Hamburg and Hobo, and then some of the mines. I love the names because they would try to advertise, so they would add names that were exotic. So then you wind up with Congo. Monkey Hollow, for Pete's sake, you know. I just love the fact that they come up with all these interesting names. Santoy was named after a Chinese-style operetta, similar to what Gilbert and Sullivan did.
In an episode like this, it can only serve as an introduction, and I can't go into all the towns, places, and stories I would like to. Eventually, we'll cover them all, especially towns like Renville and Payne's Crossing, two historic black settlements whose history is now being amplified and remembered more and more through the work of countless people. We'll talk about both those places and many others from the region in future episodes, each one of the little cities containing its own history, connections, and importance. Some like Nelsonville, New Straitsville, and Gloucester still remain intact in present day. Some like Eclipse are, but a little differently. While others like Jobs, New Floodwood, and Santoy are less visible or not even populated in 2022. Cheryl Blosser lived in Santoy, one of those company towns. Santoy is a place that today is just a few houses on a road, with the woods nearby still containing the foundations, buildings, and footprint of a town that has itself returned to the forest. An example of the continued relationship between the people, the land, and outside extractive industries.
Santoy is the after 1900 coal mine. It was put in, and it was the first all-electric mine. Before that, most mines were still being run on gas lights, on carbide, on, you know, mules, and various animals pulling the things out. But Santoy was considered to be, you know, was run, put in by the New England Coal Company. They had two mines down there, and they put in, and then Sunday Creek Coal took over, and they wanted to make this a model mine, so this thing was fantastic. And the town had electricity. There was actually a traffic signal. There was a hospital. That was the only town in Perry County that ever had a hospital. And it was only there for a matter of 20, 25 years. Interestingly, they brought a lot of the town in by rail. The houses were, in some cases, already had been assembled at another coal camp and taken apart, brought down here, and put back together. And then there were some new ones, too. So all the houses were coal company townhouses, and there's like rows of them out along the creek in the old pictures, and they're identical because it was after the 1900s. There were problems with the KKK, there were problems with strikes and just dealing with money, so there was a lot of violence. One of my favorite stories is that this guy said, well, you know, to find a body on the cob pile, and you know, they would just ignore the fact that he had a knife wound and say he died of fumes. Something for the fumes in the cob pile killed him. Nobody not wanted to investigate that.
My own professional background and interests tie into the story even more than, you know, it already being a topic that I'm covering on my podcast. I worked for many years at my beloved Stewart's Opera House in Nelsonville, Ohio, which of course we will definitely be covering in a future episode. That building was constructed in 1879 to be a gathering place and an entertainment venue for the growing boom town of Nelsonville. But opera houses and union halls could be found all throughout Appalachia at the time, sometimes several in one town. But this was specifically true in the Little Cities of Black Diamonds region. There's a fantastic book on this topic called Coal and Culture by William Condy, who also wrote The History of Stewart's Opera House and taught at Ohio University, and it's a definite high recommendation from Invisible Ground if this kind of thing interests you. And I'm guessing this kind of thing interests you because you're still listening to this episode. Anyway, long story short, I love old theaters. And Shawnee, well, that was once home to two of those theaters, the Knights of Labor Hall and the Tecumseh Theater, both of which remain in this town of less than 400 people. The Tecumseh dates to 1907, built by the Improved Order of Red Men. Definitely my most loathed of dumb historic racist names, as a fraternal hall. The theater was built on the site of the O'Bear Hotel, which itself had been created from the farmhouse and property originally purchased in 1872 by the New York Coal and Iron Company to form the town of Shawnee. Ah yes, the local Perry County roots of the New York Coal and Iron Company. The Tecumseh, like many other parts of the area, was standing strong but was in a state of decay by the mid-1970s. And that's when John Winnenberg comes back into our story.
I simplify the story by saying I came home for a visit and we bought a theater. And it was 1976 was the year, and it was the nation's bicentennial. So there was kind of this fever around history for the first time in my lifetime. Coming to Shawnee, I grew up just 7 miles away in Corning. I suddenly smelled and felt and experienced this patina of this place because it was so intact, but also in a lot of ways, rotting, and the decay process was well underway, which I've seen nothing but decay my entire life growing up here. But it just had a special sense of place to it that made this exciting. To sit here where we're sitting right on the bottom floor, this was like earthquake moving in here because all the seats were waving and the floor had buckled. The floor was wood and had rotted and buckled. And I remember standing over there talking to people during a storm, and water was just pouring. You needed an umbrella to stand on the first floor. Of course, the legendary story is, which is true, is my friend Skip borrowed $500 from his dad and we bought it.
So was it $500? Did you throw in $502?
No, it was all his dad's. I didn't have $500. I just got out of college. That's a lot of money.
The Tecumseh would be preserved, an action that's still happening today, and one that will be seen through the full renovation of the historic space on the second floor happening in the next coming years. It was the work from those early days that provided the foundation, not just for the Tecumseh, but for Sunday Creek Associates and the Little Cities of Black Diamonds organization.
when we got a roof on the building in 1977, we had a great sense when the rain stopped coming in the building. That was an incredible sense of accomplishment. And we got all the windows replaced. That was an incredible sense of accomplishment, even though we put glass in rotten window frames at times because we couldn't afford new window frames. But and there was a core group of us that were really raising money to pay the mortgage every month, you know. And that's been the story of this building from ever since 1977, as I pointed out. Just made up my mind that, along with my colleague Sandra Landis in particular, that if things are going to change here, we're going to have our own seat of influence. So we formed Sunday Creek Associates in 1990. The theater group turned over the property to this new nonprofit, and we diversified our efforts. We organized history groups in Corning and Shawnee and Haydenville and Murray City and different places, and began a really ardent collection of oral histories.
It was a small organization. They really were, they didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have an office. Most of us worked out of each other's homes and would just meet somewhere, whatever public space we could use. We had things for an archive, mostly stashed in people's, like I said, whoever had the most stuff would put it in the back room somewhere. But in the beginning, and we held meetings in different towns. The whole goal was to collect history on, there's well over 60 communities.
And that small organization has continued to grow. The next generation of active citizens, preservationists, and historians taking up the cause, like Cheryl's daughter, Kelly, an artist and game designer who returned to the area and is now involved with the group again.
My mother was one of Little Cities of Black Diamond's earliest founding members. And some of my earliest memories are sitting in corners of meetings of all of the local history groups. I feel like I grew up in this organization and then I left for a while. And then when I came back, it was inevitable that I would become part of it again.
These organizations have continued to grow, all while preserving and amplifying the history of their own communities. Little Cities Day continues each year, and oral history and archival gathering also continues to happen. The connection between the land and the people, the culture and the history, the past and the present, seems to be getting stronger all the time. And the hard work of those who began those efforts is now being taken up by a younger generation, one that brings their own perspectives and skills into continuing the ongoing work of historic preservation and storytelling. So what's the hope for the future of this region and these groups? Let's start off by hearing from a new voice for this episode, but not one for the show. Tyler McDaniel runs the Ohio and Appalachian History Geographer page on Facebook and Instagram, and is a member of the Little Cities of Black Diamond Council. What does Tyler hope to see in the future?
I said, you know, one of the things I would love to do is to create better tourism jobs and heritage tourism. The thing that I would love for us to do is to create this heritage corridor and also a physical place, a true history center, a wool welcoming center, where people can come and it's a true museum that we can share our history, a place that you can get into our archive, look at documents, look at pictures, understand, hold things, hold actual artifacts and items. Empower people around here so that they feel that they know this story. They know it accurately too, because that's the thing that I try so hard to do, and all of us at Little Cities, is to share the accurate history, not the glorified history, the romanticized history, or just the fake history.
So I see the role of these communities in the next 50 years is to keep that story alive and use it as a, not as a stationary reminisce, but as a springboard for deliberation and conversation about, you know, how do we do place in rural America? And I would love that part of it to grow a lot more.
What I'm seeing is that it's an extractive type of tourism that is starting to take root here. And so one of the biggest things for Little Cities for me is I want to reverse that process. And I think that there are multiple ways that Little Cities helps with that, starting with the preservation of our heritage and our story, because that's really the risk when you see this kind of gentrification, is that people will lose that collective culture that they have built, because they'll be physically, geographically scattered. You know, the landmarks come down, old buildings get torn down, and they're replaced with a different culture's architecture and a different type of site. And so I see it as part of what little cities can do is make sure that we remember what the heritage is of this region and that we understand that story really, really well. The other part of what little cities can do in a very practical sense is we can establish a locally owned, locally invested tourism industry.
We've worked really hard, but for a while there, everybody that was in this organization was older. I mean, we were losing people, you know, if not to vacation homes in the South, they were just losing them to death. And then the next generation, the people we'd been talking to, the storytellers that we knew, the college students that we'd been reaching with tours every year, started to pick up for us and started to join us, and they continue. And it's really important to share these stories for the next generation beyond you. So just keep the stories alive. You know, that's what I'm going to do. But these people are going to keep them alive too. In a way, you are, because I've seen what you do. You're saving history and keeping it alive, bringing it back for people. There's still a way for people to join in with us and help us tell this story, help us get more images together, help us make sure that the story isn't forgotten.
Invisible Ground is as much about the stories of history as we are about continuing discussions and observations about the connections of those same stories to the present, or even the future for that matter. Once that gets mixed together with art and music, well, that's completely and totally in our wheelhouse. Those concepts are central to the work of Brian Harnetti. I wanted to finish off this episode with an interview I did with him a little ways back, in which we discussed Shawnee, the Wayne National Forest, and the community connection to history through sound. And everything in between.
My name is Brian Harnetti, and I'm an interdisciplinary sound artist, and I focus on sound and listening as ways to foster social change.
Brian, why don't you start by telling me about your relationship to Southeast Ohio and Perry County in particular, and what is that relationship and how does that tie into the work that you create?
I'm from Columbus, and so I don't self-identify as Appalachian or as someone from Perry County, but both of my parents' families are from Perry County. My father was from Junction City, and my mom's family, going generations back, was from Shawnee. So I have connection that is, you know, somewhat detached, but also connected through family. And so that's led me to be curious about Perry County and Appalachian Ohio since I was a kid, you know, going on to visit my grandparents, for example. And I've sort of carried that through my adult life. And as I, you know, matured as an artist, I turned to Southeastern Ohio as the subject of my work. I spent more and more time, starting in 2010, visiting Shawnee and different places around Perry County and doing ethnographic work there, and focused on basically deeply hanging out with community members in Shawnee and other small little cities of Black Diamonds towns. And then that led to a series of art projects and music projects that I continue today. So I see Perry County in particular as the subject of my work, and the Wayne National Forest and Shawnee also in particular. And even though I don't live there, I try to remain involved with the communities there and act as a steward of those places.
Why do you think the history and stories of these people and these communities is a good topic to be brought into music and art that you're creating in the present day? And how did those ideas of connecting those threads come about?
One of my first visits to Shawnee, I was asking people if they had oral history tapes that they've made. I think it's one thing to make recordings yourself, but it's another to hear the things that people from a community have made for themselves. You know, I met John Winnenberg in 2010 and then asked him, and he promptly went back into his back office and produced a cardboard box full of about 40 cassette tapes. that were done in the mostly in the 1980s and maybe in the very early 90s for a book that they were producing about Shawnee to celebrate its 125th year anniversary. But what was so fascinating about the tapes is that they were essentially a generation of people that are now gone. And local people from Corning and Shawnee and New Straitsville, they were essentially, telling the stories of place that had been obscured or hidden or not thought of for a long time. You know, the stories of, the labor struggles that took place there, social things and also environmental and disastrous things too. I saw it as a group of people organizing themselves around how to identify with place and to push back on the stereotypes about Appalachia and Appalachian Ohio in particular. And so I saw that as the seeds for, you know, the Little Cities of Black Diamonds Council and all of these other wonderful things that we have today was sort of rooted in that generation telling stories of their own lives and the lives of their parents.
Tell me about some of the sources that you used for both the field recordings of music and the interviews with people. Did you come across those separately and do the music afterward? What was that selection process like? When you hear something, are you like, oh, that's definitely going to be a song?
My grandfather, Mordecai Williams, who grew up and lived in Shawnee, even though I never knew him, he died before I was born. He, you know, was the captain of the basketball team and also played in the Shawnee Orchestra and, you know, graduated from high school from Shawnee. I basically did a history of his life and, you know, found, you know, original documents of the songs that he would have played with the orchestra, or, labor songs that were popular from different labor groups in Shawnee at that time. And those became sort of notated material that I then transcribed and used and altered, you know, to create some of the musical backgrounds that I work with. I think the one that sort of illustrates this best is there's one track called Boy. It's an anonymous recording that of a child who was given a school assignment, actually by John Winnenberg, to go and record his grandmother and do an oral history with his grandmother. But what's so interesting and actually very funny about this recording is that he placed the recorder next to himself, and his grandmother was probably across the room, and so you can't hear her answers to his questions.
Do you know anybody who was in the mines? Can you tell me three people?
Now, you put out Shawnee, Ohio as an album, but you also performed it, not only at the Wexner Center in Columbus and down in North Carolina at Duke, but here in Shawnee. What was that experience like for you?
We're really fortunate to be able to perform the project, which was called Shawnee, Ohio, around the country, which included, down at Duke University in North Carolina, out in Minnesota, and, you know, several places along the way in Cincinnati and Columbus and so forth. But performing it in Shawnee was, I think, the best experience of them all. It was really actually transformational for me, and I was really struck by it. What happened was that I think it felt like half the town came out to be able to watch it. And I just loved the sort of atmosphere that was created. I mean, we had a potluck there before and during, and then afterwards, you know, we sat around and chatted, you know, as a large group for it felt like about an hour, and people were pointing out, like, well, that was my grandfather, or I didn't realize that, you know, there was a picture of me in there somewhere. There was such a connection between the town itself and the, you know, the music and the video that was, and images that were being shown up on the wall, that I just have basically been inspired by that for years. You know, Skip Ricketts was there, who was basically the person who saved the theater. And he was like, this is the first time I've seen a movie in this theater in like 40 years or something like that. And I loved connecting both with his past and his present right now, and offering a space to acknowledge, you know, all the work that they've done to, you know, hold that place up. But also it was just sort of like amazing to connect with the town in that way.
Okay, I wanted to talk about the Forest Listening Room series that you did in some of those same communities. Tell us about what that is and how it got started And how is that sort of as well connected to your other work that you had done previously?
So Forest Listening Rooms is a socially engaged art project, perhaps more so than any of the other projects that I've done before. It was basically born out of the performance that we did of Shawnee, Ohio, in the village of Shawnee, Ohio. And while we were performing, you know, we had such a strong connection with the community that was there. I was searching for ways to use sound and listening to further that connection with the people in Shawnee and then the larger Little Cities of Black Diamonds region and then in the Wayne National Forest to essentially, you know, have some sort of connection over the land itself. I mean, literally finding common ground and then use that as an ability to try to find ways to move towards social change, certainly on an environmental level, like to have discussions over how the land is used and how it might be used in the future. And then also on a sort of social level, trying to figure out moving across differences between rural and urban, for example, or across the political spectrum or other issues that might come up, and certainly the stereotypes that are presented in the region too. I would take people, local residents, they were sort of the main audience for this project. We would walk out into various places in the Wayne National Forest. We would listen critically to the forest, to each other, and then we would have sort of very carefully guided discussions about land and land use and hopes for the future. You know, the process is this. I mean, it draws on a lot of different sound artists and composers and so forth. We would start with what's called a sound walk, which is walking quietly and using your ears as your main sense, and becoming aware of all the things that we normally tune out from our listening experience. And that was followed by a silent listening session in the woods in a given chosen place, usually around, you know, 15 minutes or so. And then I would bring, you know, a couple of speakers with me, and I would play historical and archival recordings of people that lived in those places, sometimes in the very exact place or worked there from the past. And that also had a sort of haunting quality because you're sitting in a place that might have been, you know, a former coal mine, for example, and you're hearing someone's tale about that place, about working there, about the labor struggles, you know, about its environmental degradation or something like that. And it really situates you in that place. It's almost like a time machine. You can sort of like be in those two different places at once. And then afterwards, you know, we would have this discussion. And I think, you know, the trees and the forest itself almost became like a kind of mediator, and definitely changed, you know, the feelings and mood of the people that were there. And so it opened up a space for people to be able to connect and talk without feeling like it's a confrontational space.
Thanks, Brian. Brian Harnetti's newest album is coming out October 7th, 2022. It's called Words and Silences. It's on Winesap Records. Features the Hermitage tapes of writer and monk Thomas Merton. For more information, you can go to www.brianharnetti.com and you can pre-order the album on Bandcamp on his page. Thank you to everyone who's contributed to this episode, especially John Winnenberg, Cheryl Blosser, Kelly Blosser, Tyler McDaniel, and Brian Harnetti. Thanks, of course, to the Little Cities of Black Diamonds for preserving the history of this region and telling those stories, and also for being an incredible resource for me throughout. You can find out more about what they do at lcbdohio.org. Thanks, as always, to the Southeast Ohio History Center, Ohio Humanities, Ohio History Connection, Klein Penny Educational Fund, City of Athens, Athens County Convention and Visitors Bureau, Winding Road, Ohio, and all of our donors, Patreon supporters, partners, and everyone else out there who keeps making Invisible Ground happen. You can support what we do on our Patreon page at patreon.com/invisibleground or reach out to us. Be sure to go see that Barry Hotel marker at 15 North Court Street in Uptown Athens and download the Invisible Ground app for Apple or Android devices to see the history right there on your phone. If you want to support this show or you have an idea for something, email me. findinvisibleground@gmail.com. Music is, of course, as important to what we do as the stories. The music in this episode includes Brian Harnetti, Weed Ghost, Pete Fosco, Unmonumental, Howard Rollin Duo, Dead Winds of Summer, and Todd Jacobs. Todd also does their theme. We'll see you all later on in September for episode 6 on the historic Mount Zion Baptist Church in Athens. Thanks.